Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Tuesday, May 3rd. Well, you've certainly heard by now that Politico published what it says is a leaked draft of a Supreme Court ruling that would completely overturn Roe versus Wade and return the country to what was the case before the 1973 landmark ruling. Abortion rights would no longer be considered a constitutional right in this country, but would be up to each state. Also, a draft opinion at this stage is not a final version, and it could yet change. And maybe you've heard by now that many U.S. states have near or total abortion bans already on the books that would automatically take effect if Roe is overturned. The pro-abortion Guttmacher Institute counted 22 states in that category. You ready? They are in alphabetical order: Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Georgia, Idaho, Iowa, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. Some of those states you might have predicted, some of those states might have surprised you. That from the Guttmacher Institute. And how would those states compare to countries around the world that you might be curious about? Well, abortion is considered a woman's right under the law, at least in the first trimester, in the famously Catholic countries of Italy and Ireland. In 2019, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz ran an article called "Alabama, Iran, or Saudi Arabia? We checked where abortion laws are better for women." That article in Haaretz begins by saying abortion will be more lawful in Saudi Arabia and Algeria than Alabama and Georgia if the near-total bans passed by their state legislatures are allowed by the courts. The article also notes that an Alabama anti-abortion rights activist named Eric Johnston drafted Alabama's 2014 law that prohibits Sharia law in Alabama on the grounds that, quote, Sharia law violates women's rights. He then wrote Alabama's abortion ban law. One more state worth mentioning: New York State. Spectrum News obtained a video recently of the likely Republican candidate for governor of New York this year, Long Island Congressman Lee Zeldin, speaking to an anti-abortion rights or right-to-life group as part of his campaign. He said this.
It's been many, many, many decades. I don't even remember the last time New York State had a pro-life governor. It's been a very long time. We're talking about generations past.
At one point, a woman asked him about so-called pro-life access to him if he's elected governor, and he said there would be an open door. Here's that exchange.
What kind of access would we pro-lifers expect to have with you? It doesn't sound like open door.
That's right. Yeah, come on into the second floor of the New York State Capitol. It's been a while, but you come right on in.
And finally, Lee Zeldin said he'd appoint an anti-abortion rights, or what he calls pro-life, New York State health commissioner.
Go out and make sure we're getting the most qualified person to be the health commissioner who is also pro-life.
Long Island Congressman Lee Zeldin, the likely Republican nominee for governor of New York this year, in an appearance before an anti-abortion rights group obtained by Spectrum News. With me now, Mary Ziegler, Florida State University law professor who specializes in the legal history of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. She is the author of books including After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, Abortion and the Law in America, A Legal History, What Roe Means, A History, and the forthcoming Dollars for Life, The Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. She also wrote an Atlantic Magazine article last month called There's No Knowing What Will Happen When Roe Falls. Mary Ziegler is on loan from Florida State this semester, you might say, as a visiting professor at Harvard. Professor Ziegler, thanks for joining us under an extraordinary circumstance today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
First, I guess I should ask if you concur with Nina Totenberg on NPR and others that this draft opinion appears to be real, Because if it's not, Politico will have enough egg on its face for a lifetime supply of omelets.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds exactly like what one would have expected if you were listening to the oral argument in December. And it sounds very much like talking points we've heard from the anti-abortion movement for decades. So while, you know, I can't vouch for its veracity personally, it sounds about as authentic as you can get.
The draft opinion, as reported, was written by George W. Bush appointee Samuel Alito, who says Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. It is time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives. That's a quote from the draft as reported. Politico says this draft was circulated on February 10th and has the support of at least five conservative justices. Chief Justice Roberts' position is reportedly unknown. Why, for you as a law professor who follows the court, why would a draft be written in February for a decision that won't be handed down until June?
Well, this is pretty normal. There's a lot of internal politics. The court will take an initial vote. So when Politico wrote, you know, the court voted to reverse Roe, that would be the initial vote taken after conference. There were at least five votes at that conference that Roe should be reversed. And then someone in that majority would be assigned the opinion, in this case, Justice Alito. And then Justice Alito would circulate his opinion to his colleagues for, you know, comments, edits, and sign-on. So we don't know. Obviously, there's time between February and now for the opinion to change, potentially for one of the conservative justices who initially voted to reverse Roe to jump ship. But this is sort of a moment in time that reflects where the justices' thinking was in February.
Do you see any candidates among the conservative justices for jumping ship from this total overturn of Roe?
I mean, not really. I think the leak will likely firm up their convictions. They're not going to want to be perceived as changing their minds in the face of public pressure to do so. I think if there were any potential takers for that at oral argument, it might have been Amy Coney Barrett, who at some points did seem focused on the problems with viability as the line at which states could ban abortion rather than the overall flaws as she sees it in the idea of a right to choose abortion. But I think ultimately Barrett, like her colleagues, seemed convinced that Roe was wrongly decided and seemed ready to say so immediately without any kind of windup.
The draft, according to Politico, also says Roe expressed the feeling that the 14th Amendment did most of the work in the ruling, but its message seemed to be that the right to an abortion was found somewhere in the Constitution and that specifying exactly where was not of paramount importance, unquote, from the reported Alito draft. So can you give us your law professor's take on where in the Constitution the 7-2 Supreme Court ruling of 1973 did find the right to an abortion?
For the most part, people interpret the abortion right as flowing from the 14th Amendment, which is the same, the due process clause in particular of the 14th Amendment, which also recognizes rights to same-sex intimacy, same-sex marriage, contraception, the right to marry, for all couples, including interracial couples, the right to parent, and so on. Scholars, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg in subsequent years, have also suggested that there are concerns about equality for women and other people who can get pregnant. The court in the draft dismisses those as well, essentially saying, ironically, you know, we don't need to worry about that because of precedent. The court points to cases from the 70s and beyond, essentially saying discrimination on the basis of pregnancy isn't discrimination on the basis of sex. So while, you know, getting rid of precedent, the draft says we can't really talk about this whole equality thing because of precedent. So the court dispenses with most of the kind of constitutional arguments that have been at the center of arguments for abortion rights, including the ones that many think Roe were based on, but arguments beyond that as well.
You know, I've asked this question many times on the show, but I'll ask it again. Why wouldn't abortion rights be protected under the First Amendment as a matter of religious liberty? Because what I see these justices doing and the whole anti-abortion rights movement doing is to have their conservative Christianity, their conservative Judaism, their conservative Islam enshrined in civil law, when so many other denominations of our three major religions endorse abortion rights. Like, I grew up in Reform Judaism, the biggest branch of Judaism in the United States, and that branch is pro-choice. So why wouldn't we say the dogma lives loudly, to quote Senator Feinstein, in anyone who would ban abortion, because it all comes from their religious beliefs, and that shouldn't be imposed under the Constitution as a matter of civil law?
Well, I think it's, again, precedent, which is ironic for a court that seems all too ready to get rid of precedent. But the court in the 80s had essentially rejected this argument about the Establishment Clause, right? The argument that abortion bans violate the separation of church and state by saying, you know, some people who don't like abortion like it, don't like it for secular reasons. And that argument would probably have been more convincing then than it is now. I think the pro-life or anti-abortion movement is much more comfortable describing itself as a religious movement in many instances than it was in the 70s and 80s when it wanted to distance itself from the Catholic Church, because at the time it was a much more Catholic movement than it is now. But the court in the 80s rejected that argument, and I think to some extent, I think to its detriment, supporters of reproductive rights and justice have often been responding to what the court has given them. And sometimes that means shutting down arguments that may have been promising.
This reported leak is 98 pages in length. Anthony in Huntington is calling in saying he's read 30 of those pages. Hi, Anthony. You're on WNYC. Do I have that right?
Good morning.
Good morning. You've been reading this draft?
I have. I'm homesick from work, so I took the time to start to read the opinion, and it's concerning. I think that what I've read so far is completely states' rights, completely originalism, and I've never really ascribed to that philosophy of judicial interpretation. If you read through it, that some of the things that, if it in fact is true and if it in fact is Alito, what he's saying is that it wasn't, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, there was no broad acceptance of abortion rights, and in fact, it was illegal in most states at the time. Therefore, you can't find protection for abortion in the 14th Amendment. But you can make that same argument for a lot of other things that most Americans, by and large, take for granted at this time and are now on the chopping block, potentially, like same-sex marriage, like contraception rights, like interracial marriage. There are a lot of things that were illegal at the time, and if that's the standard that's applied, look out, brother. We all got a lot of problems.
Anthony, thank you for your interpretation. So Professor Ziegler, what would happen to other privacy-based Supreme Court rulings, like to same-sex marriage and interracial marriage and to contraception, all of which were enacted by the Supreme Court, finding constitutional rights that superseded state bans, as he points out? I mean, honestly, I could see the court still upholding at least some of those, the contraception and the interracial marriage, on the grounds that they are more settled law in terms of there being no public movements to contest them. Maybe the more recent same-sex marriage ruling, more vulnerable. What's your take?
Well, I mean, the caller is absolutely right that the court's arguments would apply with equal force to many other rights. So, for example, the court emphasizes that there can be no right to choose abortion because at the time the 14th Amendment was being written, there had been no, you know, abortion was being criminalized. And that's true. But of course, the same is true of same-sex intimacy, or the same is true of birth control. The same is true of sex education and books. So I think the court tries to head this off in the draft, if the draft is authentic, by essentially saying abortion is different because it's the taking of a life. But that's not without peril for the court either, because it's quite clear that the pro-life or anti-abortion movement is gunning for blue states as well, and essentially is going to say that abortion is unconstitutional, right? Wants the court to recognize the personhood of a fetus or unborn child under the 14th Amendment and to declare that abortion is unconstitutional in places like New York. So if the court essentially goes that route by saying abortion is different because of what it does to fetal life, then it's going to kind of, I think, be in accelerating the effort in the anti-abortion movement to get abortion declared unconstitutional.
And I want to play a clip of Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, pro-choice generally, defending her vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh, a few years ago. She predicted to Dana Bash on CNN that this day that may be approaching would never come. Listen.
I do not believe that Brett Kavanaugh will overturn.
His precedents are overturned all the time.
They aren't overturned all the time. And listen to the standards that he put forth in his conversation with me and also in the hearing. He says for a precedent, a long-established precedent like Roe, to be overturned, it would have to have been grievously wrong and deeply inconsistent. He noted that Roe had been reaffirmed 19 years later by Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and that it was precedent on precedent. He said it should be extremely rare that it be overturned, and it should be an example.
So you have obviously full confidence.
I do.
Susan Collins with Dana Bash on CNN during the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation process or just after it. Professor Ziegler, Susan Collins, probably lucky for her, has years to go before her next election campaign. Do you think she ever believed what she told Dana Bash there on CNN?
I mean, she may have wanted to believe it. I don't think anyone who was being serious about this or thoughtful about this believed it. But people are capable of talking themselves into all kinds of things if it's convenient. And I don't doubt that Susan Collins was sincere, but I think it was almost obviously and certainly a case of extreme wishful thinking.
Politico says Alito's draft opinion goes so far as to say that some supporters of abortion rights have been motivated by a desire to suppress the size of the African-American population. It is beyond dispute, he writes, that Roe has had that demographic effect. A highly disproportionate percentage of aborted fetuses are black. Again, that's a quote from the Alito draft ruling. Is there any legal history in all the research for your books on the topic of abortion rights that indicate Roe was some kind of genocidal attack on African Americans?
No, I mean, it's certainly true that if you go back to the founding of the family planning movement, there were racist arguments made by founders of that movement. Sadly, there were racist arguments and eugenic arguments made by many across the ideological spectrum in the United States at the time, and family planners were not exempt from that. It's also true that in the 70s, there were supporters of population control who made what are unmistakably racist arguments that legalizing abortion would, for example, lower welfare costs by resulting in fewer children of color being born. I think to say then that that is the movement to legalize abortion, that's a radical and gross oversimplification. It ignores the presence of feminists and people who supported reproductive justice in the movement. It ignores some of the historical nuances that, in other words, what was happening in 1910 is not what was happening in 1973. It's not as simple as that. So I think there's been a kind of weaponization of conversations about race that ignore some of the nuances. And I think it's unfortunate because, of course, the people who are going to be the most affected if Roe v. Wade is in fact overturned are going to be people of color, who are people who have abortions at disproportionately high rates. Also people who are policed at disproportionately high rates. So if you're wondering how would an abortion ban be enforced, it's the way laws on something like marijuana being illegal are enforced. People who are the most policed, people in communities who are the most policed, will be affected by these bans. And people who are not will largely get away scot-free, just as we saw with the war on drugs.
It's such an essential part of this conversation, right? People who are economically better off, disproportionately white women, would be more able to travel for abortions. I imagine if Roe allows it, if the overturning of Roe allows it to be banned in many states. And like you say, with the marijuana laws as a good example, the behaviors that are actually that people actually get arrested for tend to be disproportionately people of color, even though a lot of white people are doing the exact same thing. So it's such an essential part of the potential ramifications of overturning Roe. Would Alito use such a claim as the one we just cited as a legal basis for overturning Roe? And if not, why would he put it in the decision of this draft, in this draft, if it's accurate as reported, and ignore all the rest of that racial social context that we were just discussing?
Yeah, I think it's quite possible. I mean, one of the things that was surprising to me about this draft, assuming it's real, is not that the court was overruling Roe, but this feels as if it was a court that hasn't really been in touch with arguments made by people on the other side, is not empathetic to people who are feeling wounded by this today. It just feels like an opinion written by a court that's very siloed, you know, in its own legal community, in its own political community. And so it doesn't at all surprise me that this is what we're seeing, because that seems to be where the court has ended up. And that's, you know, I think not good for the country. Even if the court is going to be doing things that are polarizing, I think if the court is completely unplugged from what people who disagree with its rulings are going to think, that's likely to intensify the backlash the court encounters, especially on questions of race.
When do you expect the actual ruling?
I think late June, and that's still what we would expect. But obviously now that this leak has happened, we're in uncharted territory and we quite simply don't know. I mean, but if you were guessing, you would still say the end of June of 2022.
Mary Ziegler, Florida State University law professor who specializes in the legal history of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. Her books include After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, What Roe Means, A History, and the forthcoming Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. And she's got an article in The Atlantic called There's No Knowing What Will Happen When Roe Falls. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.